It wasn't turning.
Well, it's turning now. This wasn't recording during the length of a whole tape, and we're going to try again, which is very kind of you.
You mean starting back at the beginning now?
Yes, maybe we can edit it down a bit, but I can tell you what I found most would like most to have is your well, you said that you had gone into French because you hadn't spoken any foreign language, and you decided you better learn one, and that's when
I
you
was born.
Yes, and you came here expecting there to be Indians and no cultivated people, and you found neither. I mean the contrary.
But to make it so that I only sort of thought I'd see Indians. I didn't really see them.
Yes, just sort of thought.
Sort of thought I might see them, but I didn't. I knew perfectly well that I wouldn't. I'm sure.
We talked about the dining club, and you listed the members who were let's, shall we do that again? Because that was
Warren Weaver.
Yes. David Lilienthal.
David Lilienthal. Lord Garrison.
Yes.
Ian Morehouse.
My brother Richard Marshall, who was the
Richard
cause.
Marshall.
He was the one who started
cause,
it, was he?
Yeah.
He was he was not a university faculty.
Uh-huh.
He was the chairman of the financial committee that head of the Fowler's estate, which was he was an important person, in other words.
Yeah.
And the two Slichters.
That's right. Don Slichter is now a chairman of WHARF, a member of the board of WHARF.
Don Slichter didn't go.
He was, yes.
And
Louis, of course, is dead even before him, because Louis was about 10 years, I would think, older than Don.
You know, I think what I will do is have a pretty good memory of for this sort of thing. I will go home and say the things because of what you said about Frank and the experimental college, because I would like to have you talk about these things that nobody else knows about at all, the French department.
Yeah.
As we were starting, and we'd gotten to Gillen, and we did. I can put in what you said about the deans and the treatment of salaries. Mm-hmm. So let's just carry on, and I will. Mm-hmm. You can listen to how I repeat it and correct it if it's wrong. Mm-hmm. You were talking about Gillen. Let's just go ahead.
The dean, as for the dean, I would like to have it said that it was not I who formed this opinion of the dean. I inherited it, and I probably passed it on, but I didn't invent it.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
Yes, of course. If I'm sure you can't have been the only person to have noticed it if the dean wasn't paying much attention to what the department wanted.
I was not a member of the executive committee of the department.
That's
so
right.
I didn't and couldn't know. They were very secretive in those days.
Were they?
Yes.
That's interesting. Because you've been there for how many years? 16?
16 years, and it's still not become an assistant, an associate professor.
Why was that?
Well, there are those who said that the dean thought I was a playboy.
Ah.
You see, I dressed up
we love
as one did in the East.
We like parties and gaiety, and so, you know, there are people of a certain kind who, if you aren't solemn every minute, think you're a lightweight.
Was Celery like this?
Yes.
That was his reputation there. Whether he was actually like that, I would not be in a position to say, because I never spoke to him probably more than a minute than we all told.
Ortega, who was a big shot in
the Spanish
band,
department,
was a good friend of ours.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that Celery had said to him, "Oh, Julian Harris, he's just a social butterfly."
So this had nothing to do with teaching quality or writing?
No.
How did you feel about it? It must have...
I feel very unhappy, and I got offers to go, but there was a depression, you remember?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get an offer for a place that I really wanted to go to. Besides, by that time I was married and had good connections, quote unquote.
And you enjoyed your life here,
yes,
presumably.
And I may say, who was it that went on to be president of Columbia?
Grayson Kirk.
Grayson Kirk.
Mm-hmm. Was in the dining club.
Was he?
Grayson Kirk.
I didn't remember that. But anyway, he and Julian were in the same position, and all our friends said that it was, they just couldn't understand why Julian and Grayson Kirk were never promoted.
Recognized.
Mm-hmm. And Grayson went on to be president of Columbia, as you know.
Yes.
And Julian is probably the only professor of French at the university who was not only made by the government of France for the different kinds of things he did, not only a knight, but an officer of the Legion of Honor.
I know that was a much greater honor, even.
Really quite rare.
The only professor in the, from Wisconsin, certainly.
Yes. So that these two people, whom Sellery just couldn't bear, and refused to promote, in spite of urging.
They say, I'm not saying this, it's they who say this. I don't say that he refused to.
It sheds an interesting light on Sellery, though. I don't know much about him. I know he very vehemently opposed the experimental college.
Yeah.
And
the story was that, I don't know about Grayson Kirk, because he left the course, but that Julian finally was promoted by Frank over Sellery, against Sellery's.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. But Julian was recommended by the department, you understand. With this block in the middle.
Yeah.
But
I'm not at all sure that I was recommended by anybody, whatever.
Yeah, but anyway, we're promoted over Sellery's head, and I'm pretty sure that's true.
So you were promoted from assistant, you were an assistant professor all this time, and then...
No, I wasn't all this time.
Well, not all this time, no, but you were...
You came in
I had become an assistant professor. I was an instructor first for a long time, I don't remember how long.
In 1936, you were still an assistant professor.
Mm-hmm.
And you were giving a course in modern France for journalists.
Yes.
Remember that?
Oh, yes.
It was just before the war he was promoted to an associate professor. And then 1 year later he was made chairman of the department.
That's the way it's...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Actually, more like 1942, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, still during the war.
Someplace in there.
Well, then go on with your story about
Gillen.
About Gillen.
Well, I don't know which of the various stories to tell, but he liked to tell about how much he knew in Latin and so forth. He was a very learned Latin scholar, he intimated. He didn't say so in so many words, but nobody ever heard him quoting Latin authors, so far as I've ever heard. And we occupied the same office for a while. So I really knew him very well. And one day he was holding forth to a graduate student who was trying to qualify for a PhD in some language. I mean, he qualified for reading knowledge or something for a PhD. He was telling about the advantage, telling a student, a graduate student in psychology, I think it was, about the advantage of knowing Latin. He said, now take the word, what is the word now? Let's think, albatross. Take the word albatross, he says. If you know Latin, you can figure out what it means. Alba means white, and there you are. It's a white bird. And then afterwards, he came into my office and said, I just helped him along in giving him etymologies and telling me again about alba meaning white. And so I said, but what does tross mean, Mr. Gillen? He said, I don't know, but what does it mean? I said, I don't know, but I'm not telling anybody about the etymology of the thing, because I don't know what it is. But I would guess that any word beginning with A-L in Arabic...
Is Arabic, yes.
...might just be thus something or other. And he said, it helps to know Latin anyway. I didn't say, but you obviously don't know Latin, because after all, Alba doesn't... This bird is not a white bird, it's a gray bird. If I'm not mistaken.
Well, I think the typical story is that one day, the one Julian started to tell earlier, a professor in some department, I've forgotten his name, called up in a rage. Mr. Gillen to give him something to do because he was being paid and he was such a poor teacher and this and that.
People wouldn't take his courses.
Yeah, that no one would take his courses, or at least few.
Except he was a religious.
And
telling the things to, that made him content.
Yeah.
So they put him, had him one of the people who gave people exams as to whether they had a reading knowledge of French.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the professor, whose name escapes me, called up in a rage because one of his PhD students had gone to Professor Gillen for her reading knowledge exam. And, go on, Jules.
The student was allowed to bring his own French book to read her at the discretion of the examiner.
Mm-hmm.
But he could have read every single word 15 times if he'd wanted to. So he came in all ready to, or was it she?
She, that was the
she
whole point.
She came in all ready to read her reading knowledge. And he began to ask her if she was married and if she was pregnant and if she was going to be pregnant and if not, why not, and so forth. And finally she withdrew completely from the office and went weeping to home.
Because he told her it was a mortal sin. She left because then he went in, do you realize you're committing a mortal sin by practicing birth control?
God.
And so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so she left in tears, and naturally the professor in psychology or whatever was outraged. And she, well, so Gillen never again was asked to give a...
And was this about, do you remember when it was?
It was when Julian was tearing with us all
over. So it was in the 40s.
Yeah. And the last...
It was a long time before the war. He was making nonsense long before the orders.
The last, was it semester or year, Julian went to Mark Ingram and said, look, Mark, really this man is a menace to the department. Julian had even been told to keep out of his way by a psychiatrist who knew him.
Why?
Because he might get shot, yes.
So he was unbalanced.
So Julian arranged with Mark that he hadn't had a leave of absence for a long time,
mm-hmm.
so his last, I think it was the whole year,
mm-hmm.
he was given a leave of absence just to get him out of the way. And I would like to tell one story which is typical, and then we'll stop on because it's enough. But when he was president of the Art Association.
1 year.
1 year. This was in the early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so bad that some people who were sort of the backbone and who were interested came to me. I was then only about 32 or so, and said, Betty, we've got to get him out. If you will take it for 1 year, then we can get rid of him. We'll find somebody else. This was during the Depression. I remember the budget was $200 for the year for the Art Association. And so he came up to me in the hall at the university and said, Mrs. Harris, I just want to tell you that it isn't that I object to you personally that I didn't want you to be president of the Madison Art Association. I admire you and all your connections. I mean, really.
Gave him some
away.
Yes. That's interesting. I was looking through the department minutes yesterday, and the first, in 1940, there was a big discussion of a raise for Gillen. And they were pointing out that he wasn't a researcher, but they voted to recommend a raise. Why? You weren't there, of course.
No.
I mean, you weren't in the executive committee.
They were there because he had a following outside of the university. He was he would read aloud, entertain people by reading.
Oh, I see.
English.
Mm-hmm.
Reading English poetry.
Yeah.
Not French.
Yes.
He couldn't read French because he couldn't speak French. He was a solid French-Canadian,
mm-hmm.
but he wasn't really a French-Canadian.
Yeah.
He was just an American French-Canadian, I think. In any
yes.
case, he said it's always good, it's always good to know Latin. He said, I tell my students that the concierge is a thing, how do we say it? The concierge is a name of a person who goes out to meet the master of the house when he's coming late, and he holds a candle in his hand. I didn't say, what's the wind doing to the candle in the meantime, of course. But I said, he said, that I looked surprised. He said, isn't that right? I said, I don't know whether it is or not, but I'm not telling anybody. I said that many times. That you mean.
Yes.
Yes.
Goodness.
And he said, well, chairs means candle, doesn't it? I said, yes, but what does the other part of that word mean? And fortunately, it was a verb vowel, four-letter word in French, which he, I think, knew, but in any case, he walked out of the room, period.
Now what?
Well, his reputation.
What does it mean? It means vagina. It's a very vulgar word,
yeah,
for vagina.
Yeah.
The point was, he prided himself on knowing about music, art, literature.
I see. So he...
And so as he was second-rate, but he impressed second-rate.
Yeah.
He had second-rate followers.
So he wasn't the typical religious person. I mean,
there are a great many.
Yes. But he wasn't the typical purely religious person then. He had pretensions on all
the way. Yes.
Yes. So, well, maybe this is Samuel Rogers in his interview said the best thing he did for the department was getting you to be chairman. And that you brought new life into the department. And I suppose that's one of the things you did was to get rid of Gillen then. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
I better tell you that story too if you choose one that you like.
All right.
After Dean Ingram said, if you can get him to accept a research fee, I will pay for it.
Yeah.
So I went to Mr. Gillen and got him to accept the research leave and went down to Mr. Ingram and said, Mark, I've got the man in the bag. He said, not yet, you better wait and see. I said, but he's agreed. He said, well, we'll see. He called Mr. Gillen in. Mr. Gillen said, I won't accept it.
Huh.
I won't accept it. And he came back up to me and said, either you or Dean Ingram has lied. I said, now, Mr. Gillen, when three people are involved, any one of them might be mistaken without anybody lying at all. But in any case, I have not lied, and neither did Ingram. He said, do you mean that I lied? I said, I don't mean anything at all. If you can figure that out, you go right ahead. He blames other people for lying when he slipped the cog himself.
Yeah. So did he finally take the leave?
Yes.
He did.
But grumbling, he didn't.
It was too late. He was relieved of his teaching.
He was relieved of his teaching responsibilities.
And then we went to France for a year and got the most wonderful letters from time to time from Sam Rogers about their efforts to get Mr. Gillen out of his office.
Did you save the letters?
No.
What a pity.
But of course Sam writes beautifully. They've been our best friends, all very good friends all our life. But Sam's letters were such the carryings on, and they finally got him out and put him where he couldn't stand in the hall. He loved to stand in the hall and buttonhole anybody he could, you see. Do you think we've talked enough about it?
Probably we have, yes. I do.
He's
have
like
some...
Mary Frank. You could talk about his stories forever.
There are some issues in the French department that I know that you develop conversational French. I mean, that's considered your great contribution. Is that the way you look upon it? That for the ASTP during the war?
He and André Levesque.
Yes. Both of them.
I always mention them together. With that.
Not always. I mean, after all, I was editor of the French Review.
No, but I mean, what I'm saying with
the development of
with the books, the two together.
Because
the conversational method depends on André Levesque and Judith Harris.
Yes,
that's all I meant.
Because up until then, in the French department, the spoken language wasn't paid much attention to. Is that right?
That's right.
And I think I got that from your article, in fact. in this, the article on the French house.
Yes.
It's true, I don't think anywhere did they speak French much.
Mm-hmm.
French was, if you ever studied French.
I did, yes.
You learned how to read it.
Yeah.
Period.
That's
Mr.
right.
Mr. Stanovich was a nice old fellow, sweet and all that kind of thing, but his spoken French was really embarrassing.
Well, that's another question. At one point, some graduate students and TAs criticized or asked the department if it wouldn't attempt to get more native French speakers. Well, there don't seem to be many on the list of the department staff.
No, because they were always gotten at the low ranks. And they were teaching assistants, and we had sometimes as many as 4 teaching assistants.
Who were French?
Who were French.
Ah.
We never had less than 2.
Mm-hmm.
From that time on, and I think they have even more than that now, because the students know that they really should learn French when they've got this wonderful opportunity of learning it, and they do.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Stanovich must be given credit for the French house.
Yes, well, that's covered in the article, I think.
I see.
And but I'm glad you said that, because
mm-hmm. She's giving him a little bit more credit than he deserved on that, because Mr. Smith, who was the chairman of the department for a while, also had some importance in
mm-hmm.
getting the French house going,
mm-hmm.
which is clearly stated in my story about the first 50 years,
mm-hmm.
as you'll see.
Okay, yes, well, it's I have it here.
Yeah, I know.
And the other thing was that apparently the French language wasn't used in courses. Is that right, that when you were teaching French, say 19th century or 18th century French literature or the Chanson de Roland, did you speak French all the time?
No. Certainly not.
That was an innovation at some point.
That was an innovation. But we had always had a course given in French, the Histoire de la Civilisation Française,
mm-hmm.
given by Mr. Lévesque,
mm-hmm.
and Germain Mercier gave a course in the Théâtre Contemporain.
Mm-hmm. And she taught in French.
And both of them taught in French. But Mr. Smith gave a course in contemporary French drama,
mm-hmm.
as he used to pronounce it.
Uh-huh.
And he asked me to substitute for him one time when he was not going to be there, and I found to my horror that questions were asked in English.
Hmm.
She answered in English to the embarrassment of the smaller students.
Hmm.
Harris Lévesque was a complete innovation in its time and grew out of the war.
Yes.
Well, I don't know how much you know about this.
Well, I do know that, and other people have said it. And,
yes.
And
since that time, it's been copied and so
yeah.
far. Everywhere.
But was that something you would say that actually started here at Wisconsin? Had other people thought of it? It seems extraordinary.
It was a new thing.
People had thought of it, but they hadn't been able to do anything about it.
I see.
And may I say that they started with the soldiers that were here.
Mm-hmm.
And you're the name.
Can I tell you the first day?
Yeah.
All right, yes.
The first day here were these soldiers. And I'd been a sergeant first class during the war, and during the World War I, that is. But here are these people who'd been in the army a week, perhaps, was given to me, and I was told to teach them to speak French.
Yes.
So I said, well, hell, what books shall we use? They said, well, just use whatever you please. So I wrote out a little conversation, which to this day, 40, 50, whatever it is, years ago, still stands almost unchanged. I said to one of the captains, I said, comment allez-vous, monsieur? We had already gone over the conversation
yes.
2 or 3 times. So I said, he seemed to be pretty smart. So I said, comment allez-vous, monsieur? And he said, I said, comment allez-vous? He said, ça va bien. I said, okay, come on. The next guy, I said, quelle heure est-il, or whatever it was. And he didn't know. I mean, he said, I said, quelle heure est-il? And he finally came out with it. He said, is that right? I said, yes, well, I'll be damned. And the joy that came onto his face when he heard me say, sure it's right, of course it's right, why wouldn't it be right? After all, it's what I'm telling you.
Yeah.
And so they began to listen better, to answer better, to understand better.
Yeah.
The first day.
And Julian and Andre were having to write these lessons for a week, was that right, for as they taught them.
Yeah. I can imagine.
It was amazing.
And it's not easy, is it, to write the right kind of conversation?
We wrote the lessons day after day, fighting each other to get it better. Mr. Stennis, I remember, came in one afternoon, it was past 5 o'clock and we hadn't gone home, and we were talking very loud because you get excited about something. Yeah. And he said, well, now, you don't really need to quarrel, though. I said, we aren't quarreling, we're just talking. And he went on the way and we went on quarreling. Mm. But not using anything that wasn't good French.
Yes.
And that they would be able to see at once that this is really French, it's something we want to use. They were going to be in France, they thought, mm-hmm. in World War II.
Oh, and do you remember the story? Just for fun, they wrote an oration.
Mm-hmm.
For the American officers to make, at what occasion?
At some ceremonial Franco-American day mm-hmm. in France. You know, like Lafayette, we're here?
Yes.
That kind of thing? You know that Lafayette, we're here. No, too young to know that cliché? Well, yeah, when
General Pershing arrived during World War I,
he said, Lafayette, we're here. And everybody loved to say, Lafayette, we're here for quite a while.
Is it from,
don't you? Well, that doesn't need to be recorded, but I can't believe that's gone.
We prepared a little dictionary of French military terms, mm-hmm. and commanding officer said, this has merit, I think we better publish it. So I thought, well, we better just write him something really astounding and thrilling. Mm-hmm. So we wrote a little speech, a little oration, as Betty calls it.
Tongue-in-cheek.
Tongue-in-cheek, of course.
Yeah.
For an officer to speak at a Franco-American friendship party, of which there would be hundreds.
Yes.
With good luck. And it came in one cliché after another, just which the students loved, which the commanding officer loved, and which the visiting CO loved from Washington. And he said he hadn't heard anything so loudly since he'd been in.
Goodness, do you have a copy of it?
As a matter of fact, we might very well have a copy of it.
Well, the point is that one of them used it.
Yes.
Actually used the speech with word all the for cliches. Word when he had, with all the cliches in France
yes.
when he had to make a speech.
And they were probably pleased enough at having somebody speak French.
Well, sure, they were used to cliches. Nobody has a...
Well, it's what one normally expects in a speech anyway. So.
Yes.
Yeah, nothing so good as a good cliché.
Well, you brought up Germain Mercier, and you can see I didn't have conversational French. There don't seem to have been any women on the French department faculty for a long time, and of course nowadays it's a great interest. Whether the promotion of women in departments.
Yeah.
Did you all think about this at all in the 1940s, as to whether you were discriminating against the women?
But you replaced a woman. Julian did. You replaced Miss Gay, who was...
That's right, there were two women back in the 1920s.
Miss Gay was a medievalist, old French specialist, and a very good scholar. But she reached the age of 70 and was retired. And I was the old French person coming in and was given the job. Not her job, because she didn't have any job any longer.
Yeah. But the thing is, then there weren't any women on the top faculty.
She was on the executive committee.
After that, after she left, there are no women until when?
After Sheila happened, there were no women
in the 20s and 30s and 40s. Was this, did anybody think about this, or?
I don't know. I was so busy working in publications, and I was the editor of the French Review, and I was president of the AATF, and
yes,
all sorts of things that really take a hell of a lot of time.
And you were turning out scholarly articles all the time on old French.
Not so very many, though. I mean, that's probably...
No, but good ones.
That's all. You were doing good articles, all right.
That's nice to have that judgment. But it's, so it wasn't, because for instance, in the history department, they did talk about it occasionally, that we ought to hire a woman, but not until the 1970s did they actually do it.
Yes.
So you had Helene Cassidy and Germaine Mercier, both who've been there. Well, Mrs. Cassidy, not such a long time.
But Mrs. Cassidy had not been there for very long, and she was invited in, all right. She couldn't, I think, feel that she'd been badly treated, whereas Mrs. Mercier certainly could feel that she was badly treated.
You think she was?
Yes.
She felt she was, too.
It wasn't just the university professors who didn't do right by her, but if she'd been recommended for promotion, the deans would have cut her down, I think.
You do, even Ingram.
But did she ever produce any scholarly works or anything?
She didn't produce any scholarly work, but she produced very good students. She produced very good courses. And she was a
woman. What you say, Gillen wasn't producing scholarly articles either.
God, no. But he had a following outside the department. And outside the university.
That would put the pressure on the dean.
Yeah,
The dean had brought Gillen, you understand.
This is Celery.
Celery had brought Gillen. They were both French-Canadians.
Ah.
And so forth. There was a tie. There was one case in which a woman was promoted and her husband was demoted.
Oh. Who was that?
Michelle, was that the name?
There's a Michelle in your department.
Who was?
Greenleaf is the one.
Greenleaf, that's right. Yes, that Greenleaf. I came across her name.
And she was very, very good indeed.
Mm-hmm.
And could very well have been occupying an important post in the department, but she was not given fair treatment, and her husband was reduced down to an instructor, and lived to the end of his life as an instructor.
In what department was he?
In the French department.
Oh, I don't remember his
name. And wasn't he demoted at the same time she was promoted?
Yes.
One was at the expense of the other.
Well, that's something. The department was able to do.
It's a cruel story, really.
To my mind.
Not that he was much, but still, if he'd gotten up that far, he should have stayed there at least.
At least he spoke good French, which a great many of the people who were there did not.
And that's one thing.
And she was a phonetician of parts. She was good. Mm. Madame Greenleaf, Jean Aruel, her name was. Before she was married.
There was a Luzenska.
Okay, Luzenska.
She was an instructor.
She was recommended for tenure several times and was not given it.
Well, I don't think she should have been given it, given the rules that we had.
Mm. You mean that she hadn't published enough?
People could get tenure who didn't deserve it.
Well, that's what does it. Anyway, we all know that this was what was going on in the university.
Sure.
So it interested me that a woman was arrested in one of the French classes, a TA, for smoking in 1944.
Really?
Arrested by the campus police and sent to the board. You don't remember that?
I never heard of it.
When were we in France? No later than that.
Oh, no, this was 44, I think.
We were back by then.
We
were going
47.
Again in 49, but not...
Her name was Ettinger.
Ettinger, yes.
Yes.
Well, they must have kept it very quiet.
They discussed it in the executive committee and decided not to do anything about it.
Yeah, well, you see, he was not in the...
Well, 1944, you were chairman already.
1943, I was promoted to 1944, I was chairman, that's
yes.
right.
1943, you were chairman.
I was on the executive committee only 1 year as an assistant professor. Then I was advanced to rank of associate professor at once, you see.
And finally, you were rated the very highest in the department.
Oh, was I?
Yeah, they had a rating. They voted secretly. Each of them rated all the members of the department. And you were rated one, and Rogers was two, or maybe Levesque was two.
Rogers.
Rogers was not rated so high,
I don't,
guess.
Did Sam Rogers tell you the story, which I loved, that Julian wouldn't tell you? Julian always, you know, made recommendations each year, but he never mentioned, his own name never appeared.
Mm-hmm.
And Dean Ingram told, I don't know who told me, whether it was Sam or Bill Rogers or Mark Ingram or Bill Bandy, said that each year Sam and Rogers and Bill Bandy went to Mark Ingram to tell him that Julian should get a raise. This was just
nice.
Their own little
good
friendly.
Didn't get him though.
Well, sometimes you didn't, sometimes you didn't.
Did,
but it's just a nice story.
Yes,
with all
is.
The jealousies and. A department
right. yeah.
that these two undertook to go on their own.
Yeah, yes, it is a nice story. I gather there were some jealousies. There were Alex Croft, as I understand it, there was a kind of division of the department at some time. Is that right, with the factions?
Oh, yes, but those shifts, every department, you know.
But not important. It's,
well, they are important when you have to live with them.
Mm.
But Coughlin's in the shift. He was a good teacher, and everybody knew he was a good teacher.
Uh-huh.
And he got more or less promoted,
uh-huh.
more or less when he should have.
I see, not quite as fast.
But he could have been, he was not, again, we get somebody who was not good at publishing. And
uh-huh.
you don't publish unless you try to publish.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't try very much.
Hmm.
I'm just telling you that I wouldn't put that in the record because, after all, it doesn't even show who did publish a lot.
I mean, we could tell you all kinds of catty stories, but
yeah.
there's no
well,
point.
Well, no, they don't. They,
there's no point.
There, most people who've talked about the French department say that it was not badly riven as were some departments. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that it was
yeah.
quite a congenial. Even the TAs in 1970 said, enjoyed the department, said it, there were no, you know, it wasn't a serious problem for TAs
mm-hmm.
in the French department, it was only in other departments. Of course, you'd left by then.
Yeah.
Near the TA strike of 1970.
But we had treated the TAs well.
Yes, that's
we
what
did,
she said.
We didn't mm-hmm. promote them, whichever. Some people promoted them and then got rid of them, which is bad.
Yeah.
It's really very bad to promote somebody who isn't really in a position to be promoted.
Well, didn't you say it is more difficult for someone who has been promoted to get a job?
Yes.
Ah, I see.
You see, this was
yes.
the point.
So in a category
it,
that
it looks as if they've
it's a
tried them out and then decided they weren't.
Yes,
yeah.
exactly.
Yeah.
Throw them out on his neck, that's really very bad.
Yeah.
And the TA may think it's nice to be promoted, but then it doesn't, in the end, it's a cruel, it doesn't work out.
Yeah.
Also, if you promote a TA to the rank of instructor, you give him an overload of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
14 hours was the minimum teaching hour.
So they
horrible.
Don't have time to work on their
just horrible.
Dissertation. I would like to ask you about some of the general, the things that happened. You didn't go into the university general administration very much, did you? I know you were on the provisional committee.
Of course I didn't.
But I mean, some people were on committees of various sorts,
student
conduct and
I was in the humanities division.
You were in the, yes.
And eventually chairman of the
humanities
division.
Yes.
I didn't mention it because I didn't think it was really very important. But many people do that, but perhaps I should. Many people think it's very important.
Well, that's it. There's quite a strong division between those who say I won't have anything
yes.
to do with the committees and those who
well,
relish them,
it
I think.
That Julian
I was elected.
Is not a boaster. Boaster is not self-important.
Uh-huh.
I was going to say that for many years he was the advisor to the music committee of this union when it was first built.
That's interesting. That's not in the record at all.
And until Carl Bricken came, of course, that was those concert series, that type of, it was built up very slowly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I even played the piano.
He and Sam.
I was really fairly good.
You and you like Sam Rogers then?
Yes, he and Sam Rogers both gave Sam much more than Julian. Julian was too busy being a scholar, but they both gave public concerts. But I think it's interesting that he was on that, advised the music committee for so many years. And
yes, what do you remember any particular issues that you dealt with, or?
No, it was a group within which you spoke and gave your opinions, and they knew, one of them I remember said, that it was this, what was that strange error he made? Probably, but I can't think of it. Polyglot.
Yes.
He said, you must come to this meeting, to this party, because the guests will be here and they speak only foreign languages. And with this polyglot crew, they can't, nobody would understand anyone. Not knowing what polyglot meant, of course, not studying Greek or Latin, and studying French and after a passion, perhaps. But polyglot is somebody who speaks several languages, as you no doubt know.
I think of it as meaning a very mixed group of people.
But
is it specifically
the word
languages?
Poly means many.
Yes.
And as Mr. Gillen would tell you.
Yeah.
Except he probably wouldn't know anything.
Glottal was because of glottal. Yes.
Yes, many languages.
Yeah. What do you remember the McMurray case?
Oh yes, not very well, but I remember the people who were ready to fight, bleed, and die for him, and I wasn't.
You weren't.
I was not ready to fight, bleed, and die for him because I didn't really know the facts.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't enter that one.
Many people follow their friends without really knowing the facts.
Yes.
You know this.
Yes.
And we don't do that. I don't mean that we aren't ready to speak out when we know what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't just sign up because somebody else is signing up.
I got interested in that because I read a statement by Max Otto saying, in his opinion, this was the end of the university, of a stage in the university, and that its devotion to academic freedom and to things of the mind. And I don't know. Did you know Max Otto?
Oh yes, I knew Max all right. But I often didn't know which side he was on after he'd explained. Was he for McMurray?
That's interesting.
Was he against McMurray?
He was for
McMurray.
Yes.
Max and Rhoda were the kind that were 100%ers, particularly Rhoda. And you were either for us or you were against us.
I'll tell you one little example. In the university faculty meeting one time, Miles Dillon. And probably nobody's around to tell about
his name. I can't think what he is.
He was brought here as a professor of Irish to offset the professor of Polish, which the Poles in the legislature,
yes,
voted that there must be a professor of Polish.
Well, no, they voted for
a department
money to pay the professor, but just for one batch.
1 year.
Instead of laying down a principle, it's got to be this thing.
Yes.
That came on later.
And was that when, was he the original one?
Yes, Miles Dillon was the original.
No, we're talking about Polish now.
Well, I think Zawadzki was the original.
Yeah, Zawadzki was brought. So then the Irish people in the legislature said we must have Irish.
Oh, that's wonderful.
A chair of Irish.
Miles
and Bessie were brought. Mm. And they were really quite a couple.
Well, they were. Well, he was a real scholar. I mean, he was a
tremendous scholar. Mm-hmm. They were full of charm. And everybody, I mean, we and all our friends, we all liked him very much. But Bessie brought with her the idea, if you, the servant didn't please you, you slapped her. And she couldn't get over the fact that servants had Thursday afternoon and Sunday afternoon and evening off. Who was going to answer the door? Well, this was really rough. On the other hand, they were just charming, yeah. Particularly Miles.
Well, Miles.
This is in the 30s, is it?
There was a faculty meeting I was saying, and Miles Dillon was sitting two or three rows ahead of Max Otto, but Max made an impassioned speech about something or other. I don't remember what it was. It doesn't make any difference. Miles Dillon, as he sat down, said, "Now, which side are you on, sir? I'd like to know." But Miles, of course, Max was a strong believer in the subtleties. It's a very nice idea, but when you're dealing with a whole room full of people...
And have to vote.
And want their vote, you should say something impressive.
Do you know Hugh Wiltis?
Hugh?
Oh, yes.
But I just wondered if Max Otto would be of that sort. And Hugh Wiltis is very impassioned and... I'm just trying to think of
Hugh Wiltis of the music school.
No, sorry. This is a broadcast.
Oh, no, we know the Hugh Wiltis.
No, okay,
Papa,
no.
Hugh Wiltis.
I'm just trying to find an example of someone now who would be heavy.
But I wanted to say that Miles Dillon was here, they were here through the war, because Miles was a great scholar, a very educated person. And in fact, that wonderful musician that just died recently, that great teacher. No, the great teacher that was here so often, the 2 summers she spent at Edgewood.
Oh, the French woman.
Yeah, oh Lordy. Said she taught all the French composers.
She taught,
all the composers.
You don't mean, you don't...
No, she went to Edgewood during the war for two. She was a great friend of Stravinsky's, and as a result...
I know who you mean, but I can't... I didn't.
Nadia Boulanger.
Yes, she was here in Madison?
For 2 summers.
For heaven's sake.
Well, now, wait a minute. I was back on Miles Dillon. Nadia
yes.
Boulanger said that Miles Dillon and Julian were the two... She didn't really know Sam Rogers. Were the two most...
Cultivated
people in Madison.
Which is silly, because she didn't know very
well. Well, I'm trying to give you a picture of Miles Dillon. So that during the war, when everyone was away teaching, doing something for the war, Miles Dillon was able to teach. No one took Irish. Nobody wanted to study Irish. He taught Latin, and he taught French.
Huh.
And he may have taught more, for all I know. And because he was that kind of person that he could.
He was perfectly
willing. I didn't know anything about him. That's fascinating.
The role of a teaching assistant.
Huh.
And he thought that we were being awfully direct and so forth, but he eventually fell for our system and did a good job as a teaching assistant. Of course, he was getting a salary of a full professor, naturally, because after all, he'd been brought here as a full professor.
Yes.
And was very glad. But he was down the nose about the university in general. One day he said, "Julian," I guess he called me Harris, which is what one did in those days. "I was in the Romance Language Seminar room this morning." I said, "It's a nice place, isn't it?" He said, "Well, yes, and I noticed that there's some very serious books on reserve for students of old French." I said, "How did you happen to look there?" He said, "Because I wanted one of them." I said, "Well, they've been there all year, so any time you go..." He didn't think that my list of reserved books, he didn't expect to find them.
Really?
Even
although
he knew me, he knew that I was not in the illiterate, and I wouldn't give a serious course without the serious books. But still, he wasn't convinced enough to not be shocked when he saw Edmond Farrar and Joseph Heger and so forth, under whom I'd studied in Paris.
Yeah. Where did he study?
I don't know.
It's
important.
We say he went from here to the University of Edinburgh, and then
St. Andrews, I think.
St. Andrews, and then he went to, I mean, after the war, he did go back. And then they ended up in Ireland, which Bessie loved. His wife loved his horses, is what she wanted, and that kind of thing. But they really added color to Madison for quite a while. And Nadia Boulanger had no connection with the university.
I see, but...
She came during the war and stayed here. And in, I don't know where she went in the winter, but two summers she was Edgewood, and we saw a great deal of her. Mm-hmm. And my daughter was young, and she said, I'll hear her. Well, I won't go into that.
I was going to say, you might have taken lessons from her. Or, did you, or wasn't she so famous
then?
She
was a pianist. Yes, she was famous.
As a teacher, I mean.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I thought
she'd
go.
She
lived old. She affected everyone.
Yes, yeah. I know.
But I never heard of her giving a piano recital.
No, that's
she
what
gave,
I understand.
She gave lecture recitals, and she was here at this house for dinner with friends several times, of course. But she's not university, so we won't go on about that. She asked Julian to introduce Stravinsky at the lecture he gave, and Julian said, it's nonsense for me to introduce Stravinsky. So no one introduced Stravinsky.
He was above introduction, was he?
Well, yes. I mean, after all, good job. So now what?
Any more questions that I want to ask?
Again, what are your views of the university of Wisconsin?
It's a great university, and we have our ups and downs with the legislature, but by and large, they're much less grave. We're dealing in millions now than they were when we were dealing with hundreds of thousands.
They're much less grave now.
The difficulties are much less grave because everybody knows that the university has to have money, and everybody seems to be willing to give them some.
I see. You mean at one point you couldn't be absolutely sure that they wouldn't just say, well, that's enough of the university.
And the regents in those days could also say the faculty proposes raises that we can't afford to pay.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing used to be prevalent. But so far as I know, of course I'm not on it at all now, but so far as I know, then they have no difficulties of that sort. It's just a matter of degree, how much they get. It isn't a matter of whether, and I haven't heard of the faculty overruling, overruled.
That's true.
I haven't known of the faculty being overruled by Dean in a hell of a long time. I may just not have heard about it.
We're pretty much out of touch now, of course.
But what I'm interested in is when you were here. Uh-huh. Did you know that the university, the Curdy Carstensen history is being, they want to bring it up to the 1970 and mm-hmm. hire somebody to write it, and they're doing the research now. So it's the period in the late 20s. It ended mm-hmm. with 1920. Did you ever read it or any bit of it?
No.
Was that Bob Reynolds?
No, Merle Curdy.
Oh, Merle Curdy, of
and
course.
And Vernon Carstensen. Yes. And they carried it up to 1925, and now they want to write the history from 1925 to 1950 and 1950 to 1970.
Is this the Curdy book that was written?
You have. Good for you.
So way back then, it didn't take long to read a book of this kind.
It's two thick volumes.
I know.
Well, you probably skimmed through it.
I tell my students that you got to learn how to read fast and know what's in a hell of a lot of more books than you're going to ever read or understand. So it takes a long time to read a book seriously, and you can do a halfway job very quickly. That was before the days of rapid reading or whatever it's called, speed reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know how to tell them how to do it, but I told them they had to learn.
In French they had to.
Even in French, of course.
Yes, all right.
French is really easier to understand than English if you know French, because it's less equivocal.
I suppose we should finish with Julian, but I just thought of that the whole social life of the university has changed. You see, I'm a professor's daughter.
Yes.
And it used to be town and gown, and then it got to be not much town and gown. I mean, not much town. Not much mixture. Mm-hmm. Of course, I've all my brothers lived here, some of them, and so forth. Mm-hmm. We've always known mm-hmm. town people. And then, as the university got big, it even got to be just department within the department.
Yeah.
Or maybe, you know, in other language things. But whereas, when I grew up, in a way you knew everybody.
Mm-hmm. That's what I've understood.
And it was really, I think it was wonderful.
Yeah.
And because I remember my father's and mother's parties and dinner parties and hearing them talk about parties or even earlier and so forth.
Did you go to the university club very much? That's supposed to have been a place for mixing.
I always went to have lunch, rarely to dinner.
But you did go to lunch?
Oh, yes, always.
And did you meet other people in other departments there?
Yes. We sometimes had a luncheon club that would last for a year.
Oh.
Sometimes.
Well, name some of the people that you like to meet there.
I can't name them.
The reason he went was to see.
I tried to go to think, now who were those guys? One of them was in the fire.
Did you know E.B. Fred very well?
I knew him fairly well.
But I would imagine you didn't move in the same circles, really.
Yes, we did.
You
well,
did?
In a way. Not. They lived just. We belonged to what she was called. You want to know what society in Madison? There was this, what they called the Francis Street group.
Mm-hmm.
And it was faculty mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And the Freds lived there on Francis Street, right? Mrs. Slaughter and Janet Van Heist sort of were the pivots of this. And they had lots of parties, and they all had days at home. And you went to have tea at Janet's on Friday, and Mrs. Slaughter's on Wednesday, or the Burns on Thursday. And there were
and you did this
people.
Too?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And there were other people. You could go any day of the week to have tea at somebody's house. And it was fun. And then finally, Janet Van Heist introduced having cocktails. At 5 o'clock. Tea started at 4, and then later you could have cocktails. And so Mrs. Slaughter, I think, didn't, she was older. You must know who Mrs.
Slaughter Oh, yes, Gertrude her. Slaughter is, you know, I, all right, go
so
on.
So but she didn't, I think, quite want to introduce cocktails into her teas.
Mm-hmm.
So she had a bottle of rum, and you could have rum in your tea.
A little correct.
Well, that's
not
nice.
A bottle, though.
So, you see, I go way back into, the Slaughters were among my parents' best friends, this kind of thing.
In a very elegant house. We had...
It's ending.
Okay.
I'm sorry, yes.
Mrs. Slaughter used to say she didn't know what she would do with her house. You see, she had no heirs, and she had nephews, but they were both rich as Croesus.
Mm-hmm.
And so Julian said to me, you know, that might make a nice French house. Or I said to Julian, I don't know which. And so we had this in mind for some time, but we waited for the strategic moment.
Mm-hmm.
And one night, we were having supper at the Bandys.
By chance?
By chance, Mrs. Slaughter was there, and Mrs. Slaughter happened to say, you know, I just don't know what will happen to my place. And so one of us, I don't know which of us, spoke up and said, you know, that might be a wonderful place for a French house. The old one is going to be torn down, and it's too small and too old anyway. And so she said, what a wonderful idea.
For heaven's sake.
But it took us, we waited until the right
moment.
I've learned that from running the art associations and things like that.
Trusting that it would come along sometime.
Yeah, oh, yes. Well, you know, we were her, the Rogers and Harrises were her best young friends because Trudy Slaughter was my very best friend. Until she died.
Yeah.
We used to, first we'd sleep at her house and we'd sleep at my house. We said, my mother said, we said we instead of I.
Huh.
But then she died when she was 14.
Did you know the Naplins? I mean, did you move in the, you weren't in the same, because she entertained a lot and.
If you would turn it off.
In your list of women.
She's been interviewed also.
Oh, she has been interviewed.
Yes. Were you responsible for bringing her here?
I was.
You were? Oh, good.
Not really. Not really.
We both were. She's been a friend of mine. I had invited her to be on a committee at the AATF when I was president. And I got to know her very well, because that was a very important committee that I got on to. And she was with us thereafter. When it was a question of getting her actually to accept a job here, Betty brought her out here and said, "You can just be indiscreet as hell if you wish, and I'll repeat anything you wish me to repeat." She decided to stay. And
I answered all her questions and told her what I thought about it. And I really think it had something to do. She'd been looking at, she was ready with questions.
She was ready to leave New York, too.
Yeah, and that was the real reason she came. Well, I think she could have gone plenty of other places, of course. But she was ready to leave New York. And then she left here because she was tired of the winters.
You're saying the real reason she came was because she was ready to leave New York.
Well,
why choose here?
That's right, because she was human.
What I mean is that she was ready to leave New York and was looking for someplace.
But why did she choose Madison?
Well, that's, I don't know.
The Humanities Institute is why she stuck to Madison and the people that she knew. She, I don't like to say she liked me, but I liked her very much. And
well, I suppose then that your friendship was an important factor.
It certainly was. In North Carolina now, she, although she's past her retired age, people that she went there to see, and the climate, of course, is important.
Yes.
But we got her to come to Wisconsin on a permanent basis. Let's say permanent until you retire.
Yes, that was a coup to get somebody like that.
And I think this is interesting and might interest you. I knew this is, we had, she knows Julian's sick, of course, and that I'm not well. And we had the sweetest Christmas card, but she speaks of our deep friendship. It goes back through the best years of my life.
Here?
Yes. You see?
Goodness.
I think that the fact she said considers the years here her best, that's what I was pointing
out. Yeah, yeah.
So, next subject.
Well,
few years as an instructor were quite frustrating, because I just come from 3 years in New York and Paris, where I had been one of the best people who exist for my field of expertise. So that I was, as I say, quite frustrated for year after year. I didn't get promotion, although I was publishing, and I was teaching, and I was studying. And I think I counted it was 18 years from my first appointment to my arrival, to my reaching the rank of associate professor, which is, you've already seen. To me, it was a very frustrating experience. To others, it was, well, there's Julian Harris will take the next office that comes along, that kind of thing. I didn't, as I said a while ago. Of course, after all, the University of Wisconsin had a very good library, and their system was that if you asked for something to be bought, you could get it bought. And we had the interlibrary loan. One time I wanted to get a book that we have in the library, but it wasn't on the shelves, and I went down to see if they could find it for me. The librarian, the custodian said, "Yes, we can find it for you, but it's in the basement of the law building." I was amazed. And they said, "The reason it's there is we haven't got room for it in the library." And I said, "Well, can you get it?" And they said, "No, you can't get it until 19-whatever. I said, "Well, what do we do?" He said, "In the library alone, it's just And in 4 days, the library and the library owner got me the book. Huh. I mean, there was real cooperation between the library and scholars.
Mm-hmm.
This library book came from the Library of Congress, and God knows how it happened to get there in the first place, but it was a very important work, and they behaved very importantly, mm-hmm. I thought. Then, that brings us down to the war and the teaching methods and things.
Well, but I'd like to ask you, in regard to your sense of disappointment and disaffection, was there anybody in the French department whom you could talk to about this, whom you could complain to or get some understanding of why it was happening, that you weren't being promoted? Did you have, I mean, you obviously knew Sam Rogers.
I knew Sam Rogers very well.
About this to him?
Rarely even approached it at all.
Was it because it wasn't done? Or because he wasn't the kind of person to talk about this sort of thing to?
It wasn't done by certain people, others did it every year. It wasn't done. Some people would say yes, that it wasn't being done, whereas in some cases it was being done every year, year in and year out.
But by your standards, I mean.
By your standards,
it wasn't the thing to do
I would like to have that letter. I wrote a letter to the dean over the head of the department telling what the situation was as I saw it.
To Celery, this would be?
Yes.
Yes.
He didn't even acknowledge it, so far as I can recall, let alone act upon it. So I was pretty much by myself. The Vic was an enormous help when it was a question of creating this method,
mm-hmm.
but getting it accepted is quite another matter, as you know.
Mm.
And some people, my father was a wealthy man,
mm-hmm.
because my grandfather founded the Marston Ilsley Bank, which is all over the place now. And some people thought father supported us, which he was very careful not to. I mean, mother'd buy me a dress or two, and father'd bring us out a few bottles of good whiskey. But that was it, because he didn't want this. It had happened to him that people would be jealous and so forth,
yes.
because he inherited. And so he tried to, they avoided helping us, except when I had a baby or something like that.
Yes,
any parent helps that.
But you were living on your 22
yes.
50 or whatever.
And I don't know what this was leading up to.
Well, you were going to say that people thought you had enough money and therefore didn't need a raise.
Well,
probably.
I think that, I don't know, but I think this had something to do with it. But it may
Well, you must have been. I mean, I know how wives react to this sort of thing. One says, well, why don't you talk to somebody about it? Or did you?
I talked to Sam Rogers about it, but rather offhand, it was never a vital point.
Well, and the promotion finally was over Celery's head.
Mm-hmm.
It was Glenn Frank that finally promoted Julian. And Celery did not agree.
Mm-hmm.
There was some reason Celery thought Julian was a social butterfly.
Yes. Well, you did say that, but that's really, it seems a strange explanation. If his teaching was good and...
That no one has ever been done all that he has for the teaching of... No one who's ever been here has done all he has for the teaching of French and been not only a... knight, but an officer of the Legion of Honor, and
you're repeating that.
Oh, I'm repeating. Yes. Okay. But
well, it's hard to get at the bottom of something like that. I know one man I've interviewed recently who he was a chemist, and his salary was recommended to be raised, and they didn't raise it. And apparently, although he's evidently a very fine research chemist, he never got the proper salary and treatment of the department. So there are
precedent.
You yourself did eventually get what you deserved.
And of course it might have had something to do with my father's being a well-to-do man. Having been in the in the university for so many years. I don't know.
I don't think you should worry about that very much.
I don't.
Well, it is true that sort of thing wouldn't happen now.
No.
I don't believe. That is, the people are raised on their merits and as to teaching and research
teaching
and public service, and it doesn't matter whether they got $1 million in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, during the First World War, my father did without a salary at all, you see.
Hmm.
Because the university was so very, very hard pressed. Not during the Second World War, because everything else was hard pressed. He needed his salary.
Yeah, yeah. Well, go on. I asked you to.
I became, as I said, after 18 years, I became an associate professor and was in on everything. I was elected to the Humanities Division, mm-hmm. Executive Council. Pretty soon got an appointment at the Institute for Advanced, at the Wisconsin Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And things piled up. I really had to work overtime to keep my irons hot. I couldn't bear to, I should have perhaps done better if I'd just stuck to one thing, though I don't know whether that's a realistic guess or not.
Nobody seems to do that. How did you organize your working day?
I didn't. I worked until everything that had to be done. I tried to do it before it had to be done.
Did you get up early?
No earlier than the rest of the family. Well, but we had a child in the house. But
he left here not during the war. Then everything was, classes were earlier, as you may, but ordinarily, aside from the war. He left here at 7:45 and got home about 6:15. Mm. And he did have lunch down at the university club until Anne grew up and went away to school.
Mm-hmm. And then you came home.
And then he started coming home. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which is much better food. I don't think that should go down in history, though.
Well, I don't think there'd be much disagreement with that either. Did it worry you that the university president was a scientist and the vice president and the dean of the graduate school? Did that sort of thing, or the war money went to the sciences? Did you think about that sort of thing?
No, I don't think so. The scientists, on the whole, I think, were more tended to facing facts than the humanists.
Hmm.
It'd be difficult to substantiate that.
Yes, it would, I think.
But I think it would be, you could make a case that the scientists were more level-headed than the humanists. In fact, during the war, or World War II, we were in a carpool, and I noticed that the humanists were the ones who got hot under the collar all the way down week in and week out, year in and year out. Whereas the humanists didn't seem to learn, and the scholars, the scientists, did.
You mean the scientists were willing to put up with carpools?
Yeah, oh sure.
Hmm.
Everybody will use carpools. Shouldn't say everybody, but lots of people did. And I thought it was rather interesting to see how they talked.
You didn't use one much, because you used to take the car and I would take the bus to my studio downtown, and then we'd meet.
Well, that was only a period of
mm-hmm.
X months.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You were saying that the conversation of the scientists, I thought you meant that the humanists didn't put up with carpooling, got tired of it. But what you're saying was the conversation was so different.
Yes, what they had to say, the characterizing experience was, I thought, that the scientists were more willing to face facts than the humanists. The humanists wanted to talk about it, which is a good thing, of course. But when facts come, then something should be done about it instead of continuing to terrain.
Hmm. And you thought the humanists were haranguing.
I learned not to, from my experience with the humanists, I've learned not to be a 100% humanist.
That's a good mo.
Well, I don't mean it as a mo.
Well,
I think that my experience learning, doing research, learning how to do it in the first place, doing it in the second place, working in the Bibliothèque Nationale and that kind of thing was an extremely important part of my education, of my experience too.
I don't know that you need to call research scientific necessarily, so, but we better not.
Well, it's different than just word counts.
Then what?
Word counts.
No, that's talking about something different.
All right, I take it back.
Yes, that sounds like a language sort of thing. I don't think historians think of themselves as being scientific when they're doing research. And anyway, why don't...
This could be a long discussion.
Yes, it could. Well, I don't, and all right, and do you have then your observations, have you got something else? I had asked him if there were things that I hadn't thought of asking, mm-hmm. And you mentioned two.
Which one about, did I mean?
Well, the 18 years and your dissatisfaction with that, and then your observations about the reactions of scientists and humanists to the war, so.
Well, I can also give you a third. My reaction to the way that French and other languages mm-hmm. were taught, not just here, but every place in the world. They just didn't teach what needed to be taught, mm-hmm. and didn't teach it what they did teach, they didn't teach efficiently.
Mm-hmm. And that was your great contribution?
That was
yours and Levesque's?
It paid off, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean...
And their book is now in the ninth edition. I mean, one of their...
Seventh.
Well...
The seventh edition, darling. It's
okay.
The ninth edition.
But anyway, it's
all
just
right.
Coming out in another
edition. Is it as widely used
all
as
all
it?
These years.
And is it,
although everybody's been copying it, so
yes,
to speak.
Yeah.
And this method has been...
Yeah.
Some of our conversations have been borrowed in extenso.
And for other languages, probably, too.
Particularly for other languages.
Mm-hmm.
The ones in Spanish and in German were authorized translations.
Really?
Yes. I get royalties from them even.
That's interesting. You mean they were decent enough to say, may we translate this?
They said,
this
could we do it and we'll pay so and so? And I said, sure. Go ahead. I thought it would be nice to have a good book to learn German because I was so very, very bad at taught German. I still can't read German to this day, although I know a hell of a lot of words. You don't learn by reading, by memorizing words, of course, as you surely must know.
Well, the thing I regret is that I know no German. That's the language I would go try to learn. Well, maybe we should bring this to an end then.
Okay.
With the proviso that we'll then have an interview with you sometime, and that you could sit in on and
yeah,
actually,
I think
that would be interesting.
Because I can remember things I'm sure nobody can.
Yeah.
And they all had tea, as I said. They took turns having tea.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go and have tea any day. And those days we all had maids, which was lovely.
Yes, that made a big difference.
And poor Mrs. Slaughter never understood in later years why her teas weren't so popular. And the reason her teas was that people no longer had maids to look after the children. So they had to, they couldn't go.
Mm.
And she did, some children went. The Rogers would sometimes take one or two of their children with them. I don't think we ever took Anne. Anne was a little younger. But, so this Francis Street group was very sociable. Joaquin Ortega and the people in the wood, what it has to do with forest products. And they had lots of parties, and they have dinner at different houses beforehand. And I think this was part of it, the fact that Celery thought Julian was a social butterfly.
Let's not go into that any further.
Yeah. But anyway, it was lots of fun. And after all, Sasha, Professor Vasiliev, who was one of the best professors they've ever had, just loved these parties.
He was one of the group then.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I remember dancing on this floor with Anne when she was 4 years old.
No, but I mean, these were dancing parties.
Yes, I know, but
But the teas, and there were lots of graduate students. Francis Stiegler, who's since then become quite famous, would go to all these places for tea drinking. It went on for years.
And there were people from the Ag campus also, were there? Or, I mean, that's why I spoke about Fred.
Well, they lived there, and they were, but they never mingled with, they were friends with these people. But as far as going to this type of social thing, no. I don't remember ever seeing Mrs. I may have seen Mrs. Fred there. Mm. I never saw Mr. Fred there, I think. My father knew Mr. Fred pretty well because...
Yes, he was...
Both being an entomologist and the other interested in agri school would be interested in entomology and so forth. But it was lots of fun. But it was curious how outsiders reacted. They didn't like this.
Yes, I'm sure not. It must have seemed very exclusive.
And it really wasn't, accepting that somehow Mrs. Slaughter and Janet had a way of making people feel not very at home if they didn't want.
Oh,
and the C.K. Leith used to go in the early days before he went to Washington. And he was, if you don't know C.K. Leith, you don't know the history of the geology department.
All right, I guess I don't.
Well, he was the geology department. And there were others, but he was the big shot. And I had a brother who studied geology here as an undergraduate. And as an undergraduate, he was given his own study. So then as a graduate student, he went to, I don't know, just where, Cornell or someplace where there was a good geology school. And he went up to the head of the department and said, "Now, where is my office?" And the head of the department looked at him and said, "What office? You're just a student." anyway, C.K. Leith was really a big shot, and then he went off to and was very important in Washington with minerals.
He was a good friend of Franklin D. Roosevelt.
And you see, I know a lot of this old history from simply having. I remember Benny Snow. You must have run across Benny Snow.
I know the name.
Who was the? I would say the original physics department. And I took a course under, but he was a friend of my father's because they both loved Oriental rugs and would count Benny Snow would come to my father's house, they'd turn over the rugs and get out with their magnifying glasses, count how many stitches in this new rug that father had sent from Chicago or something. But, how did I get away from C.K. Leith? Well, except...
Well, you got to the rugs, but that's far enough to go out there.
Yeah, but anyway, he really was very important in his time. And they had great big parties, great big dances.
He was a very rich man, and they had a magnificent house there in the islands.
And people did it.
They could invite everybody in town.
And people had far more dance parties in homes then, because the rooms were big enough. And one thing, I don't know whether the social part of it interests you, but I think it's part of what life was for people, and for the fact, these were faculty people, almost exclusively. One year they had, part of it was at the Warner Taylor's on Francis Street, and the rest of it was Janet Van Hise's, which was right across the street.
Catty Corner.
And Warner Taylor was in the English department, and they had a tremendous party, and I was commissioned to make little plaques, souvenirs for everybody.
and had two orchestras. But the orchestra at the Taylor's had too much to drink before enough people were there. So they sort of passed out halfway in the evening. So Janet and Isis' house, which fortunately I think was rather the larger space of the two, had to absorb the dance. But then they were swished back to the Taylor's to get food and so forth.
Are you talking about 50 people, 25, 100?
Oh, 100, I think. Wasn't you, Julie? 85.
There were more than 50, certainly.
More than, I'd say, 85 or 100.
At least there were 30.
I should know how many blacks I made, but I don't.
Yes, it's a certain thing you'd expect to remember, wasn't it?
All I remember is I never got paid.
This is in the 20s.
Oh, no, that was a different party for which I made the plaque.
Yeah.
Well, no, this was later than the 20s.
It was.
Isis and Zora Lindley decorated the apartment, too. She was a very beautiful Spanish lady, coming from Arabic background, we think. Obviously, she came with an El Pau, with her unmarried name. And she was a liberal and couldn't stay in Spain because, after all, the liberals were not tolerated at that moment.
Well, what?
And she added a lot to the...
Well, they didn't go to the dances, though.
What?
They didn't go to the dances.
They went to the parties, though.
Well, yes, some, but they were different.
Yes, they weren't...
He was probably the most important person that's ever been here in the Spanish department. Now, whether they've talked about him or not, I don't know. That's my judgment.
So.
I've
interviewed Neil Silva, but I don't think he said anything about Sola Lindh.
Well, he died.
Neil Silva, yes.
Yeah. He died fairly young.
Uh-huh.
And she was the most beautiful person you ever saw.
Hmm.
And her father...
Very beautiful.
What happened was that her uncle, or was it her father, was the steward to the king, or the governor of Morocco, that was it. Maybe both, maybe one was one. And so when the Civil War came, the families... sympathies were all with the revolutionaries, but because of their connection with the uncle, who'd had such an important post under the king, they were all suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And the brother, who wanted to fight with the rebels against the king, was executed by the rebels. And Antonio Sola Lindh was to have gone to Spain to marry Jesús Alfau. And then the revolution broke out. And he got a telegram or cablegram saying, stay where you are, we're coming. And that was Jesús and her mother. Jesus' father was dead. And so they left Spain and came and were married in this country because they were sympathetic with the revolution, and Sola Lindh had left Spain because he'd written a letter which had been intercepted by the king's people. And in that letter he had expressed Republican sympathies. So he'd fled. And then with the revolution and what had happened to the Alfau brother, she and her mother got out and came here to be married in New York. Well, you know, during the war in the Ulam, you know who Stan Ulam is.
No.
Oh, he was the one who made the atomic bomb.
He invented the atomic bomb.
Ulam?
Stanislav Ulam.
U-L-A-M.
That's all right. I
don't believe it, but you can make a note that I
ask any professor.
You can make a note that I
who Stan Ulam was. Uh-huh.